My name is Andrew Davis. I'm the music director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and today I plan to speak to you about Hector Berlioz's dramatic legend, Le Don Nation de Faust. If you've listened to Lyric's commentaries before, you know that we always illustrate what we're talking about with recorded musical examples. Today's excerpts are taken from an EMI Classics recording featuring Nicolas Yeda as Faust, Gabriel Baquier as Mephistopheles, and Janet Baker as Marguerite. Georges Prêtre conducts the Orchestre de Paris. Very special thanks to EMI Classics for providing these excerpts, and to Nicholas Ivor Martin for his assistance in preparing this commentary. Before we get to the recorded examples, I'm going to make you do a few examples, so I hope you've done your warm-ups. Imagine you are sitting in your seat at the opera and that a cello plays a single long note. Okay, did you hear that? Now imagine the same note played by the flute. Well done. Now, what was different? Not the note, but you could tell that one was a cello and one was a flute. What was different is something we in the business call the colour. When you play a note on a cello or any other instrument, you actually are not playing just one note. The wood of the cello vibrates. The other strings vibrate a little. The result is there are lots of other pitches mixed in with the main one. All those things blended together give you the sound you recognize as coming from a cello or a flute, or any of the other 16-plus different types of instruments in the standard orchestra. 17 if you count the conductor. If you've ever thought about what a symphony or opera composer does, you probably wondered how he invented such glorious melodies. But how does a composer decide who gets to play what? Why is Lucia accompanied by a solo flute in her mad scene and not a clarinet? Why does Madame Butterfly open with the tune jumping from the violins to the violas to the cellos instead of racing through the brass? There is no right answer to these questions any more than there is to why a composer uses particular notes in a melody. It sounded right to him. And if he's lucky, it will sound beautiful to his audience. I don't have to tell you that opera is the ultimate collaborative art form. It was multimedia centuries before the word was ever invented. The composer writes the music, the librettist writes the words, an orchestra of anywhere from 1 to 100 musicians interpret that score, along with solo singers and chorus. Meanwhile, the stage director arranges the visual pictures with the help of the set and costume designers, the lighting designer, all the people who build and manipulate the scenery, and on and on. Even if you realize this when you're sitting in your seat watching the show, you may not think about how many different skills have to be possessed by some of the individual people contributing to the result. The conductor, of course, has to know something about the human voice and about every instrument in his orchestra. But the composer also has a wide range of responsibilities. After he writes the tune, the melody, he has to tell everyone who isn't playing the tune at that moment what he or she should play. This is called the orchestration. Naturally, some composers are better at one thing than at another. Modest Mussorgsky's opera Boris Godunov is one of the staples of the opera repertoire. But for years after it was written, there was a general agreement in the musical community that he was a terrible orchestrator. Everyone wanted to perform his opera, but rather than being forced to play what Mussorgsky actually wrote, most companies turned to a different orchestration, done by Mussorgsky's good friend Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. Rimsky wrote Scheherazade and The Flight of the Bumblebee. He was thought of as one of the greatest orchestrators of the 19th century. But when it came to writing melody, Rimsky received his share of complaints over the years. In his memoirs, Dmitri Shostakovich, who also wrote his own orchestration for Boris, complained that fellow composer Sergei Prokofiev never did his own orchestrations, instead making his graduate music students do all the work. Berlioz, like all the great composers, was more than a one-trick pony. But until this century, he was generally thought of not for his glorious melodies, but for his almost unerring sense of which note to give to which instrument. Think of the extraordinary musical shapes in his Symphonie Fantastique. The focus on this particular talent of Berlioz's was understandable. He was extremely good at creating musical color. He even wrote a book about it, publishing his Treatise on Instrumentation in 1844. The book is still used by musicians today because of its many important insights. But the treatise also gives us a clue to why Berlioz has only come into his own in the last 100 years. After writing about each of the different instruments, Berlioz goes on to discuss the orchestra as a single unit. As he explains, the orchestra may be thought of as a single large instrument that is capable of producing simultaneously or in succession a multitude of sounds of different kinds. He discusses the proper number of instruments of each type to include in an orchestra for different types of music, working his way up from chamber pieces to a 120-piece concert orchestra. This is huge, but comparable to the size of the orchestras that Richard Wagner and later Richard Strauss would use. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra today employs 107 musicians. Berlioz, however, doesn't stop there. He next suggests that what would be really fun would be to assemble an orchestra of every competent musician in Paris. He lists every instrument he would include, 30 harps, 120 violins, and on and on and on. Then he adds up the total, making math errors as he goes, until he comes up with an orchestra of 467 instrumentalists. For the chorus to be heard over this cacophony, he figures he would need 360 choristers. And adding 467 to 360, he counts an incorrect total of 867 performers. There is a common prejudice, Berlioz writes, that large orchestras are noisy. But if they are properly composed, well-drilled, and well-conducted, and if they are playing real music, they should be called powerful. Indeed. Berlioz can be an incredibly subtle and delicate musician, but he did an excellent job at being his own worst enemy. For years after his death, his fame as an orchestrator, coupled with his personal fondness for bombast and drama, obscured his greatness. Orchestration was not the only thing Berlioz was known for. Many of his symphonic compositions were so-called program music, meaning they had specific dramatic content. Years ago, The New Yorker ran a lovely cartoon in which you see a composer busily penning his latest symphony while his thought bubbles are filled with pictures of waves and the spray of a storm at sea. In the final frame, a rapturous audience listens to the finished work, their own thought bubbles overflowing with pictures of a dark, deserted forest. The nonverbal nature of musical composition makes such misunderstandings only too possible. To avoid them, Berlioz pioneered the use of leitmotifs, short musical phrases associated with characters or ideas. He wrote program notes, performance notes, anything to make his meaning clear. In this, he prefigured Richard Wagner and Richard Strauss. But for all Berlioz's interest in telling a story, he was not primarily an opera composer. His Don Nation de Faust is more of an oratorio or cantata than it is an opera. Always one to break new ground, Berlioz called Don Nation a légende dramatique. When Berlioz sat down to compose Don Nation in the 1840s, the Faust legend had long been on his mind. In particular, the composer adored the Faust plays of German poet Wolfgang von Goethe, almost as much as he loved Shakespeare. Berlioz read Goethe in 1828, around the same time he first attended a performance by the Irish Shakespearean actress Harriet Smithson. He sat down to compose his Opus 1, which he entitled Eight Scenes of Faust. Meanwhile, he chased Harriet Smithson around for years, finally convincing her to marry him in 1833, in spite of their still not speaking a common language. The eight scenes received good reviews, so the contrary composer tracked down every copy he could and burned them. In the 1840s, Berlioz was at the height of his powers. His Treatise on Instrumentation would be printed in that decade, and he had already premiered his opera Benvenuto Cellini at the Paris Opera in 1838. Cellini caused a riot because of its challenging tonalities. Equally alarming to audiences was his 1830 Symphonie Fantastique, the piece that to this day remains his best-known work.
Darnassien was equally puzzling to audiences in its 1846 Paris premiere. Two performances at the Opéra Comique were received with polite apathy, causing the cancellation of subsequent performances. "Nothing in my career as an artist wounded me more deeply than this unexpected indifference," Berlioz wrote in his memoirs. Part of the reaction was due to the fact that, as with all his compositions, Berlioz insisted on breaking new ground. The piece was based on the Goethe poem, as well as on the 8 scenes that Berlioz had composed 20 years earlier. But in the Goethe poem, Faust is saved. There is no damnation. Today, Darnassien is recognized as one of Berlioz's masterpieces. It is a challenging work, requiring enormous musical forces and great artistic craftsmanship to pull off.